The author Richard Russo has been writing about a burned-out mill town called Gloversville in New York State for years. In one Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, he called it Empire Falls. Morning Edition's Linda Wertheimer spoke to Russo about his memoir Elsewhere, in which he looks back on the actual town of Gloversville and his relationship with a very intense and neurotic mother.
When you begin the book, you paint a picture of a kind of a gallant woman, a single mom, very proud of her job, very proud of her good looks. And it turns out your book was about her.
Yeah, as I dove deeper and deeper into this book, it seemed to me, and this is very odd for a memoir, it seemed to me that my job was to stay out of the way of this story. And so it has more to do with my mother's life than it does mine. And it has a lot to do with this place that we shared because she grew up there, too, in Gloversville, just as I did. I don't write books in order to explain my experiences of life. I write them to make things make sense. And there were large aspects of my mother's life that I didn't quite comprehend. And when you don't understand a parent's life, in a way, you kind of don't understand your own.
Now, I'd like to ask you to read an excerpt from the book. There's a point in the memoir where your life really begins to spin out of control. It's where you, having bought a clunker of a car, made the decision to go west to the University of Arizona. Could you read to us from the book on page 38, beginning with, I expected
my mother to put up stiff resistance to this plan. After all, I'd be 2,500 miles away. And her mantra had always been that we were a team, that as long as we had each other, we'd be able to manage. So I should have been suspicious when she didn't object to my heading west. But even if I had twigged to the possibility that she was up to something, I never would have grasped the obvious inference. And it was years before it occurred to me that maybe the westward ho notion hadn't been mine at all, that she'd steadily been dropping hints. For example, that the best place to study archaeology, my current interest, was the desert southwest, and that I'd dutifully been lapping them up. Nor did she object when, in the spring of my senior year, I announced I wanted to buy a car. The reason she didn't, of course, was that we would need one, because she was coming with me.
Now, that was a big, big clue as to what the rest of your life would be. And I kept having the feeling that you still didn't quite get it.
Oh, I was a long way from getting it.
Now, you went on to finish college. You got a PhD. You had a series of good jobs. You were teaching in universities. You married. You had children. A lot of that is not really discussed in the book. The story that you're telling through the sort of into your middle age is still you and your mom.
Yes, I have a good deal of fun with it in the book in the sense that, you know, from the time that she first entered my marriage, no matter where we went, my mother always had to come with us because she needed to be nearby me for kind of psychological reasons, but she also literally, we could never go anywhere for longer than it took for milk to spoil, because the milk would spoil, and she had no way to get more milk.
How did you feel about her while it was going on? At a time when, you know, when most children separate from their parents and begin their own lives, you did not. I mean, your wife, I nominate her for saint.
Yeah, me too. You can second my motion on that score.
But how did you feel about her, your mother?
There was an evolution there, as there usually is in relationships. I still remembered the brave young woman who did so much on her own when I was young. But I'd be lying to you, Linda, if I didn't say that there wasn't a whole world of resentment, of course, that built up just not because I didn't want my mother in my life, but that she didn't need to be there, you know, every minute of it.
At one point, you seem to be saying that you began to kind of become your mother. You imitated her behavior in that you tried, when you decided to quit your university job and just live on the writing and move to the coast of Maine and buy a beautiful house, it was like an escape to an imagined future. That's the kind of thing she did.
Yeah. And as I wrote this book, so many of the forces in her life, so many of the, you know, the fact that we both grew up in Gloversville, the fact that we're both genetically, I think, obsessives. And when I looked at the same forces at work in my mother's life, and I saw there were times in my own life when I was imitating her behavior without ever meaning to, that for me just deepened the mystery of destiny, the way in which the same traits that close off one person's life actually expanded mine. When I found the right obsession, when I discovered writing, I found an obsession that was every deep as all of my other obsessions have been, but strangely enough, wasn't going to kill me. And it actually opened new doors to every aspect of my life. But this was not virtue on my part. This was not even intelligence. It was simply that I had stumbled onto something that was actually going to open my life up, open my future up, instead of closing it off, where all of my other obsessions, brief and more lasting, had done.
Do you think that you would have been able to do what you've done in your life with a different mother?
No. What I'm ultimately facing in the writing of this book is the understanding that all of the blessings in my life, the things that I value most, are traceable not just to my mother, in some strange way, also to her demons.
Well, thank you very much for this. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Linda. I enjoyed it a lot.
Richard Russo's latest book is a memoir. It's called Elsewhere.
And you're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Alyssa Block. A young mother sets sail from Ireland after the potato famine, traveling across the Atlantic to meet up with her husband in Canada. Two gold prospectors seek their fortune in the frozen Yukon. A slave poisons his master, and the master's wife joins him in escape. These storylines of characters on the move come from a new book of short stories by the Irish writer Emma Donoghue. Her last book, the novel titled Room, was an international bestseller, and it got a lot of critical acclaim. Emma Donoghue's new collection is titled Astray. Emma, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and thank you for pronouncing Astray right, because it has shown up on a few press releases as Ashtray.
Ashtray.
Which strikes me as a great title, but for a different book.
A totally other book. Well, I wanted to have you read some of the opening section of one of the stories that I mentioned. It's called Counting the Days. It's the story about the Irish mother sailing to Canada to meet her husband. Her name is Jane Johnson. She's on board the ship, the Riverdale.
And the year is 1849. What has appalled her the most on this little floating world of the Riverdale is not the squalor, nor the hunger, but the dearth of news. No one has left their company except for that old man who died of dysentery last week. No one has arrived unless you count a stillbirth down in steerage. The only gossip is the rumble of clouds and the occasional protest of gulls. The passengers have to spend their time guessing what is happening in the real landlocked world, now split in two for them like an apple, where on one side people weep for them and stare into the horizon that has swallowed them up, and on the other side, others stare back, waiting for the first glimpse of them.
And Emma, we learn in your author's note after the story that Jane Johnson and her husband, Henry, were real Irish immigrants. Where'd you learn about them?
You know, I just keep an eye out for these things. I read social history. In art galleries, I read the little captions underneath the paintings. I listen to the radio and just keep my ears open. I think the only difference between me and other people is that when I hear of an interesting historical incident, I immediately write it down and Google it. I'm just a very persistent researcher, and I find things all the time. I would say the 14 stories in Astray come from about more like 40 different incidents that I came across. But not every incident makes a good short story, because I've got to find a fresh angle, a new way in. For instance, one of my stories is about Jumbo the elephant, who is quite famous in himself. but I only found a way in to write about him fictionally when I decided to focus on his relationship with his keeper, who literally used to spend every evening lying around chatting to Jumbo and drinking whiskey with him and massaging his tongue and giving him little cuddles. So, you know, I don't attempt to write a short story unless I could find my own peculiar angle on things.
And where did you find this couple, this Irish couple? Where did you hear about them?
Well, their letters were published by a descendant of theirs, actually. And so all the lines of theirs that I quote in the story were from letters published in the 1940s. And that's just a perfect source for the fictional imagination.
What was it in the letters that got you going, that made you think, I can build a story around their relationship?
Because it's actually a very interesting marriage. You could see the strain, you know. She'll write, you know, slightly guilt-tripping him about, could you not please send a bit of money to help us come out to Canada? And he'd write back saying, can you come? And she'd write back saying, well, hang on, I have to raise the money. And you could tell each of them is slightly suspicious that the other is actually enjoying this time apart. And he would write very confidently saying, oh, it's great out here. You know, every man is just as good as his master. There are no more class distinctions. And then he'd say on the back, literally scribbled on the back of the envelope, bring the gun. So, you know, you knew that no one country is ideal, that there were always perils and terrors to emigration as well as pleasures. And so you could really see this couple negotiating their marriage through these letters. Nothing bland or simple about them at all. And of course, what really seized me was the poignancy of the situation, that he got cholera and he died the very day he was meant to come and meet her off the boat. So I'm just a sucker for a tragedy.
And you've given away the ending.
That particular one, yes. That's the only spoiler out of the 14, I promise.
I'm talking to Emma Donoghue about her new collection of short stories titled Astray. Emma, the title of the collection suggests people who end up really where they shouldn't be, who've gotten off course somehow. Is that how you think about it?
You know, Melissa, there's no neutral language about travel. Either travel is described in ways that make it sound sort of, you know, shallow or just glossy or silly or a way for rich people to spend their time, or else travel is often described in quite derogatory ways, you know, like immigrants swarming across borders, for instance. So I think a lot of the language of travel takes on moral overtones, you know, concepts like being a vagabond or a drifter. I think very often we're nervous of people who change place and we assume that they're coming to steal our jobs and marry our daughters. So I think in the title of this collection, I really wanted to emphasize the ways in which travel is never just travel. There are always overtones of people straying across other borders that they shouldn't be crossing, breaking laws, or several of the stories in my book are about people disguising their sex, for instance, or having interracial relationships, or in other ways, stepping over those very important lines in the sand that each society draws.
Did you find that these little historical nuggets that you found in documents and letters really lent themselves to short stories? Or did you ever feel like, I really want to take this character beyond into a longer form? Maybe she's her own novel.
That has happened to me in the past. For instance, my novel Slammerkin was meant to be just a short story years and years ago. But I realized in trying to explain why somebody would pick up a meat cleaver and kill somebody with it in 1763, I actually did need the full novel form to explain that one. But actually, I think the short story is perfect for many of these cases because, for one thing, a short story doesn't have to trudge through a whole life. I mean, not that a novel has to either, but if you were writing a whole novel about some of the people in these stories, you might feel obliged to sort of tackle their entire life. And what I love is that a short story just sort of comes in sideways for a brief intervention. For instance, I've got one short story about a woman called Molly Monroe, who she spent the last quarter century of her life in an asylum in Arizona. She was the first woman that Arizona locked up for insanity. And, you know, I don't want to have to tell her whole life with its very long, slow, sad ending. What I wanted to tell was the story of one particular adventure she got up to that just lasted a couple of days. So in a way, you can catch people at their most alive and their most unexplained and peculiar and maverick if you come in sideways and make them the subject of a short story.
Emma, we mentioned that your last book, Room, was a huge, huge success, set in an 11-by-11-foot room where a mother and her 5-year-old son are being kept captive as prisoners. How liberating was it for you to go from the confines of that tiny space and that feeling of entrapment to this feeling of motion, of wide-open spaces and a whole new life that's opening up?
Well, you know, oddly enough, writing Room didn't feel at all confining for me because I was in the head of a 5-year-old and they know no limits, you know. I mean, they're away with the fairies or off in outer space all the time. I mean, they have the least confined imaginations that I know. But I certainly did love in Astray having to explore and get to know 14 different worlds. I mean, it's not an efficient way to use your time. You know, you have to do enough research for each story that you could probably write a novel out of it. But it's like going on 14 different amazing trips.
Emma Donoghue, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
That's Emma Donoghue. Her new collection of stories is called Astray.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Deb Perlman loves to cook, and she doesn't think you need a gourmet kitchen to make something delicious. For the last 6 years, Perlman has been blogging about cooking on her website, The Smitten Kitchen.
Perlman tracks down and tests the best recipes for food she thinks pretty much anyone can make. When she's done, she snaps a picture of the final product and posts it on the blog. Her recipes, photos, and funny posts attract some 8 million views per month. And now they can be found in a book, The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook. NPR's Lynn Neary visited Perlman in her tiny New York City kitchen and sampled some of her cooking.
When you try to picture Deb Perlman's kitchen, think of the smallest kitchen you can imagine, and then take away a few square feet. Really.
Come on in. Welcome to The Smitten Kitchen. All 3 by 6 feet of it.
This kitchen is so small that when cooking, Perlman literally has to wedge herself between the stove, a four burner with no spare space, and the refrigerator. The landlord told her to put it in the living room, but she refused. And there's only one counter, 2 feet by 3. But it does have a big window that lets in lots of light and a black and white checkerboard square floor that Perlman loves. You don't need a big kitchen to cook good food, says Perlman. But it does help to be organized.
You just need to clear the decks of what you have. You need to, I mean, I don't have any canisters out on the counter. I do have some seasonings, and I pretty much make sure it's completely clear when I get started each morning.
This is a tiny counter, really. Is this it?
Is the whole thing. This is, but you know, when you go to a restaurant and you, like, they have amazing food, all those line cooks, they do not have more space than this. They just have a little station, and they know how to manage it. They do prep work, and they put it in little bowls around, and they have one cutting board, and they have one knife, and they get their work done in a small space.
What do you hear from your readers? Do you have a lot of people who say, I have a tiny space, too. It's so great to know that you can do everything you do in a small kitchen, or...
I hear people say, I have a tiny kitchen, and I don't think I can cook the stuff that you cook in it. And I'm like, they may not realize that my kitchen's tiny. And I'm like, you can't use that excuse with me. You're going to have to find another one. I think that you just have to be hungry enough to deal with it. Like, when you really want to make something, you're not going to say, oh, but my kitchen's too tiny to make the soup I wanted to eat for dinner. You just have to pick what's really worth it, and you'll do it.
Perlman is a perfectionist, but that doesn't mean you have to hunt down precious ingredients to cook her meals. She writes for people who don't necessarily have a lot of time or money. So if a recipe calls for olives, for example, she'll try it with the canned variety and let her readers know if it works. The morning I visited, she used the humblest of ingredients to make a simple but delicious breakfast. Potato pancakes with a fried egg on top.
And these are just those everyday baking potatoes. I think they're the best for latkes. I've made versions with fancy potatoes. I've made them with butter, Yukon Gold. They're all great, but you don't need it to make good potato pancakes.
Perlman puts the potatoes into the food processor sideways so they come out in long, ropey strands. She shreds some onions into the mix, then wrings out the excess liquid in a tea cloth.
Look at all of this. It comes out. All of
that. Now, if you didn't take that liquid out, how would that affect
it? It's for a soggier, steamier pancake. It won't get the same crisp edge to it.
She tosses the potatoes and onions lightly in a mix of flour, one egg, seasoning, and her secret ingredient, a little bit of baking powder. The mixture looks like it will barely hold together as she puts it in her favorite cast iron frying pan and cooks it over a very high heat.
So we're going to eyeball here, like a quarter of the batter. And I'm going to spread this out, this mound, this like bundle of hay. Go ahead and flip it.
Wow. Okay, I'm impressed. Because I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, That would never hold together if I made that pancake.
But those long ropes. And that egg, it really does do it. Those little strands are coated with egg, not enough that it's eggy, but just enough that it holds together. So that egg and flour together with the potato starch really makes it work.
Now, do you hear back from people who read your blog sometimes that say, I tried this and it didn't work for me, or...
I think that the comments over the years have been a huge help in developing, I think, my cooking meter, because I know what I want to cook, but I don't really know all the ways that other people are going to have trouble with it until I read the comments, and so it's really been great. You know, I'll know that somebody's going to say, do I have to use table salt, or what if I only have Yukon Gold potatoes, or my eggs are small, not large, and all of these questions, like, I can answer them very quickly because I've been answering them for years, and it's, I hope that it's helped me become a better recipe writer.
When the potato pancakes are a golden brown with crispy, lacy edges, Pearlman takes them out and keeps them warm in the oven while she fries some eggs.
And again, I'm going to get this pan really hot because I personally like fried eggs that have been cooked quite quickly.
When Pearlman places her crispy fried egg on top of her crispy potato pancake, it looks pretty as a picture. And Pearlman says, at this point, she usually gets her camera.
I would do it right this second. You want to see?
Yes, I do.
I keep my camera right outside on the nearest shelf that's taller than my son. It's always ready. The only thing I would do is I would probably clear a little of the clutter off the counter, not all of it, because it's a real kitchen, but just it's pretty cluttered, so I might take one or two things off so you know what you're actually supposed to be looking at and not the fact that I haven't done dishes yet today. And I would just take a picture, just like that.
Let me see. Oh my gosh.
And that's it. You can see it looks pretty much the way it looks.
And just like that, Pearlman has taken a photo you'd swear she spent hours arranging. Which means there's just one thing left to do.
Le voilà. Breakfast is served. All right. Dig in, guys.
And yes, it's true. It tastes as good as it looks.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Even having watched you, I'm thinking, what did she do to get this flavor quite so good?
Reporting from the Smitten Kitchen, I'm Lynn Neary.
And you're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
A new collection of satiric essays by popular Chinese blogger Han Han is out this month for the first time in English. Han has taken on everything from corrupt Chinese officials to the nation's conformist educational system. His blog is read by millions, and he has developed a loyal following on the Chinese equivalent of Twitter, 8 million strong. He's only 30 years old, with boy band good looks, and he drives race cars. His book is called This Generation, Dispatches from China's Most Popular Literary Star. Recently, NPR's Frank Langfitt met with Han in Shanghai, and he has this report.
Not so long ago, many Chinese commentators wrote in a cautious, oblique style designed not to offend the nation's famously humorless leaders. Then came the internet, blogs, and a cheeky young man named Han Han. The voice of China's post-80s generation, Han was ironic, skeptical, and blunt. He wrote what many young Chinese thought, but dared not say publicly. Here are some of Han's sharper barbs, as read by NPR producer Hansi Lo Wang, on the state education system.
I participated in quite a few essay competitions. Before each event, I had to brainwash myself and check to see what slogans were in fashion.
Han on the rule of law.
We learned that the first article of the Constitution is if we say you're guilty, you're guilty.
And on the growing gap between the rulers and the ruled.
The main contradiction in China today is between the growing intelligence of the population and the rapidly waning morality of our officials.
Han said he hopes his writing will encourage some of those officials to change China's system.
For me, I hope intellectuals and the public can put more pressure on them, pushing them to reform. They will only reform when there is pressure. If they're quite comfortable without feeling any pressure and making easy money, why reform?
Han says he developed his pointed style of writing after years of suffering through dreadful prose in China's public schools. I'm really terrified by those unreadable and boring articles, he says. As a young student, he first took aim at the nearest authority figure.
At that time, I would write articles about my dissatisfaction, including what's bad about the school and the teachers. But the silliest thing I did was I handed the articles to my teachers, who felt very unhappy after reading them, saying, "You can't write this way."
Later, in the freer air of the internet, he could and became a star. Eric Abrahamson runs Paper Republic, a Chinese literary consulting and publishing company in Beijing. He likens Han Han to another generation that challenged the status quo.
If we're talking about America in particular, you'd have to go back to sort of the counterculture era of the 60s, because that's really what's happening in China now. You have a younger generation that's rising up against a more conservative, more staid, more restricted older generation and trying to throw off that yoke of authority. And so I think you'd have to go back to Bob Dylan or J.D. Salinger.
Abrahamson is quick to note that Han is not in the literary league with those icons, but does capture the dissatisfactions of many youth here. If Han Han is a generational symbol, he doesn't seem like it in person. We met in his office, a sparsely furnished apartment in a residential tower in a downmarket part of Shanghai. Sitting on a beat-up couch next to a bookshelf littered with empty Coke cans and old foreign magazines, he was polite, engaging, and soft-spoken. In the last year, though, Han has come under fire for supporting the slow evolutionary reform of China's authoritarian system instead of democracy.
If you are against the system and are to overthrow it, of course, it's a good thing, but sometimes you have to pay a high price for that. Actually, the system can be turned into a mere figurehead. Under these circumstances, you're probably paying the lowest price. And as you change and everyone changes, the system will probably change as well.
Andrea Liu is 27 and works in Shanghai's financial industry. He's a one-time Han Han fan, and this sort of talk disappoints him.
Now his stuff feels like it's written by a middle-aged person or an old guy. For example, those blog posts on democracy. His general idea was, this is what our society is like and we can't change it. He seems to have lost his edge.
Some critics think Han has been pressured by the Communist Party to tone down his writing. Han denies it and suggests that no matter what he writes, he's bound to be criticized. To make himself clear, he switches to English.
Sometimes I write some article. Maybe the article is not good for Chinese government. They said I took money from America. Sometimes I write some article, I said the government is right. So people said, I take money from government. So in China, lots of people think somebody do something, have to take money.
In China's increasingly open public debate, almost no one is spared. People are freer to question authority and challenge each other, especially major figures like Han Han. Frank Langford, NPR News, Shanghai.
The military writer Thomas E. Ricks spent years covering the war in Iraq. In the middle of it, he took a break to study a battlefield from World War II in Italy, and he learned a surprising fact.
After the toughest battle of the campaign, the commander of the 1st Infantry Division, who had just won that battle, Terry Allen, was fired. And my jaw dropped. I thought, I've just come out of Iraq, where we are losing a war, where nobody gets fired, where combat ineffectiveness is just not relevant in judging a general. No generals get fired for combat ineffectiveness these days. How could the U.S. military have changed so much?
That question propelled Rick's latest book called The Generals. He reviews decades of U.S. military history, and he argues that the military gradually lost its practice of ruthlessly holding military officers accountable for failure. Tom Rick's story begins with a man who did relieve commanders, General George C. Marshall, who built up the U.S. Army to fight World War II. Before the fighting even began, Marshall fired hundreds of officers he considered deadwood, and he continued to relieve, retire, or reassign officers until he found men who did the job. So who was George Marshall?
I've been thinking about this because I actually have to give a speech in December to the George Marshall Foundation in Richmond, Virginia. Hmm. And I'm feeling a bit antsy about it because I think the first sentence I'm going to have is George Marshall was not a nice man. I don't think he really was a nice man. I think he was a decent man. I think he was a good and great man. Mm-hmm. But he was a rather cold, reserved guy. Dwight Eisenhower, then a young brigadier general, comes up from Texas and meets with George Marshall 1 week after Pearl Harbor Day. And Marshall puts the question to him, how should we fight the war in the Pacific? Eisenhower says, give me a few hours. He writes a 3-page memo that lays out what he believes the strategy should be. When he gives the answer, hands the memo that afternoon to Marshall, Marshall looks at him. And Eisenhower wrote later, the eyes were the coldest I think I'd ever seen.
So he's a ruthless guy, he's a cold guy, but that anecdote about Dwight Eisenhower points to another part of this guy's management style. He picks out this young officer, Eisenhower, and brings him in and immediately gives him a really demanding task. Take a few hours and sketch out the strategy for the entire Pacific War.
Yeah, have fun, yeah. It's striking that Marshall devotes so much time to finding the right man for the right job. He did not see officers as interchangeable. He did not say, well, who's in line for the next job? I'll just throw whoever it is, which is kind of what we did in Iraq, which another thing that bothered me. Okay, you know, do we have a lieutenant general lying around? Give him the job. So, for example, in the natural course of events, George Patton was much more senior to Dwight Eisenhower and would have been one of the people you'd consider for commanding the Allies in Europe. But Marshall knew George Patton well and knew he was not the right man for that job.
Very talented, but not the most stable of guys.
Yeah, a little bit nutty. But he knew Dwight Eisenhower's reputation, didn't know him well personally, and eventually he picks Eisenhower. There were certain characteristics he was looking for, and these were not naturally the characteristics that we see in generals in other countries. He wanted determined, optimistic team players. And Eisenhower was very much a team player.
So you describe this guy, George Marshall, who was ruthless, who sought a certain type of officer and kept relieving commanders until he found the officers and could promote the kinds of officers that he wanted. You then go on to write about succeeding years, and you write here late in the book, after the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, the top American military officers in Hawaii were drummed out of the military. After the surprise attacks on 9/11, no one was fired or took responsibility, nor were subsequent setbacks punished. What changed?
I think several things changed. First, our wars changed. World War II was an understood war. People knew why we were fighting, and they were, as a nation, people were behind the war. Our subsequent wars, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, were far murkier affairs. And success was very difficult to define. What does success mean when you're trying to get out of Iraq, when you're trying to get out of Afghanistan? Second, the Army went from under Marshall, believing that it foremost was a force fighting for a democracy, that it needed to be democratic in its treatment of soldiers, that it needed to favor the interest of the enlisted soldier over the interest of officers.
Oh, meaning that if an officer was getting people killed, the officer had to go.
Yeah.
Went from that to a different mindset, which was?
A different mindset in Korea and Vietnam, in which they were kind of looking after the interest of officers. So they begin a rotation system in Korea so everybody can get a taste of leading in combat. In Vietnam, not only do they have a 1-year rotation system, for officers, they make it a 6-month rotation system in which you command a unit for 6 months and then you have a staff job for 6 months or vice versa, whereas the enlisted guy still does a year in combat. Again, they say this is to season the officer corps, but really it was to give a lot of guys the ability to say that they led in combat. And it was a lousy way to run a war. And I think even the Army recognizes that now. And now they have units come in and rotate on a unit basis rather than as individuals.
You go on to the Army as it existed at the beginning of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, where you feel that things are a lot less flexible, nobody ever gets fired, people are not held accountable for failure that often, at least within the military itself. But that was at the beginning of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Have things changed again over the past decade?
Yeah. When push came to shove at the end of 2006, George Bush realized that simply listening to his generals was not working for him in Iraq, that we were really losing that war. And so finally, in December 2006, Bush turns away from his generals and turns to a couple of retired generals and some civilian experts and says, what do I do? And they said, you need to think about your generals differently. It can't just be he's a great American. You need to ask yourself, is this guy effective in his strategy? You know, are we winning? And so at that point, they turned to General David Petraeus, who, interestingly, is not particularly well-liked in the Army. And he takes a radically different approach. It's not just the surge of troops. The most important thing was a different attitude, which is, let's start asking questions of the Iraqis. How can we do better? And they actually go to the insurgents, and they put them on the American payroll. So Petraeus shows some real independence of thought, the ability to think critically and independently, to understand the war he is fighting. He's an adaptive general.
Is there any sign of going back to that army of George Marshall's era where people who were seen as not getting the job done are simply relieved?
I wish we would, but I think until we hold our generals accountable for being effective, that we won't see much change in the way our military is led. We won't see that kind of adaptiveness that I think we need in our leaders.
Thomas E. Ricks is author of The Generals, his latest book. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And you can read an excerpt of The Generals at npr.org. This is NPR News.